BBC Radio 4, Professor Geoffrey Richards returns with the first of five programmes in a new series of The Radio Detectives.
Dashiell Hammett, America's leading detective fiction writer and creator of Sam Spade, the hard-boiled private eye, and William Spear, radio's outstanding producer-director of mystery and crime drama, join their talents to make your hair stand on end with the adventures of Sam Spade. Presented by the makers of Wild Root Cream Oil for the hair. And now, with Howard Duff starring as Spade, Wild Root brings to the air the greatest private detective of them all in the adventures of Sam Spade.
Sam Spade, the original Private Eye, Private Dick, Gumshoe, Seamus. The archetypal hero of a new kind of detective fiction, the hard-boiled school. The detective, a tough loner, a cynical professional, but behind the hard-boiled exterior, a bruised romantic who, against the odds, clings to a code of honour and decency. His beat, the city at night, where society, both high and low, is sleazy and corrupt. The classic British detective of the Golden Age was the gentleman amateur, trained for nothing, but ready for anything. He was well-spoken, impeccably mannered, and moved with ease through all levels of society. The American hard-boiled detective was his polar opposite. What were the characteristics of this hard-boiled school? Cultural historian Peter Stead.
Well, this is, if you like, the American response to the British tradition. In the 19th century, the great detective had been invented in Britain. And I think this got a lot in Ian Rankin's argument. There was an element of snobbery in this, that British writers couldn't really believe, you know, that a great detective would actually be a policeman. It had to be an intellectual. So they invented the private detective. But of course, in America, pulp fiction needed, I think, to democratize that tradition. So the great detective went down market, and the hard-boiled dick emerged, you know, out of America. It was a blue-collar response to an existing tradition. So the police stories, the detective stories, were set on the streets, reflecting the violence of the streets, and of course reflecting the language of the streets. A new language was being created. So very much an American democratic response to an existing tradition.
One of the earliest and most influential exponents of hard-boiled detective fiction was Dashiell Hammett. What were his qualities as a detective story writer?
Well, Hammett came into existing tradition. It was a tradition very much associated, of course, with the Black Mask magazine, which had emerged in the 1920s. Actually founded by Mencken as a literary magazine, but it became almost totally associated with these hard-boiled writers. And, of course, Hammett developed this already existing tradition of the lone operator, the continental op. But if you actually look, I think, at the qualities of his writing, two things, I think, stand out. These are the hallmarks of Hammett. First of all, his concern with motive. Very, very much concerned with why crime happened. His crimes are rooted in a particular causal pattern. We see this in his first novel, which, you know, many people admire greatly, Red Harvest, which is set in an industrial town, Personville, Poisonville, as it's pronounced, described as an ugly town in an ugly notch between ugly hills with a sky that looks as if it came out of the stacks of the factories and the mines and so on. There, the great motive is, you know, industrial corporate greed. And what he does is pile up the detail after detail, in which that theme of greed is worked out. Individual greed, political corruption in the Glass Key, greed for wealth in the Maltese Falcon.
You know, Sam, I never would have faced myself in this position if I hadn't trusted you completely.
Oh, that again?
But you know that's so.
You don't have to trust me as long as you can persuade me to trust you.
But Sam, darling...
Well, I think we better let it go at that until we see what happens after Gutman gets here.
The fat man? Here?
Certainly, why not? Anyway, that should be him. So it's too late to change our plans. I'll be right back. Oh, hello, Gutman.
Good evening, sir.
I see you brought company. Come on in. Now, look, Angel. Gutman brought a couple of friends along.
Good evening, Mr. Shaughnessy.
Hello, Joe.
You look unusually charming this evening, my dear.
Thanks.
The gunsel doesn't talk, Angel. Get away from me, punk.
Stand still and shut up.
Listen, you're not going to frisk me, touch me, and I'm going to make you use that gun. Ask your boss if he wants me shut up before we talk.
Never mind, Wilma. You're certainly a most headstrong and unpredictable individual, Mr. Spade. Now, why did you send for me?
You ready to make the first payment and take the falcon off my hands?
The falcon?
That's right, Angel. I've got it.
Well, sir, I have in this envelope $10,000.
$10,000? Oh, we were talking about more money than that.
Yes, sir, we were, but there are more of us to be taken care of now.
Well, that may be, but I've got the falcon.
I shouldn't think it would be necessary to remind you, Mr. Spade, that though you may have the falcon, yet we certainly have you.
Yes, I'm trying not to let that worry me, but let the money wait. There's another thing to be taken care of first. We've got to have a fall guy.
I beg your pardon?
Police have got to have a victim, somebody they can stick for those three murders.
Two. Only two murders, Mr. Spade. Thursby undoubtedly killed your partner.
All right, two then. Now, the point I've got to give the police, a victim when the time comes. If I don't, I'll be it. Let's give him Wilmer here.
Why, you dirty rat.
He actually did shoot Thursby and Jacoby, didn't he? Anyway, he's made to order for the part. Let's turn him over to them.
By God, so you are a character, that you are. There's never any telling what you'll say or do next, except that it's bound to be something astonishing.
Well, it's our best bet. With him in their hands, the police will forget the rest of us.
Your plan is not at all practical, sir. Let's not say anything more about it.
All right. I have another suggestion. Let's give him Cairo.
Well, by God, sir.
Suppose we give him you, Mr. Spade, or Mr. Shaughnessy. How about that, huh?
Sam, you wouldn't.
You people want the fork, and I've got it. A fall guy is part of the price I'm insisting on.
You seem to forget you're not in a position to insist on anything.
No? If you kill me, how are you going to get the falcon?
By God, sir, you are a character.
Well?
Well, what else can I do? I'm sorry, Wilmer. Terribly sorry. I want you to know that I couldn't be any fonder of you if you were my own son. But, well, if you lose a son, it's possible to get another. And there's only one Maltese falcon.
Humphrey Bogart as Sam Spade in a 1943 radio version of The Maltese Falcon, featuring Mary Astor, Sidney Greenstreet, and Peter Lorre, his co-stars from the 1940 film version. Sam Spade was perhaps the most enduring creation of Dashiell Hammett, and a character who directly inspired Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe. Chandler was an enormous admirer of Hammett's style.
Hammett took murder out of the Venetian vase and dropped it into the alley. Hammett wrote for people with a sharp, aggressive attitude to life. They were not afraid of the seamy side of things. They lived there. Violence did not dismay them. It was right down their street. Hammett gave murder back to the kind of people that commit it for reasons, not just to provide a corpse, and with the means at hand, not hand-wrought dueling pistols, curare, and tropical fish. He put these people down on paper as they were, and he made them talk and think in the language they customarily use for these purposes. He had style, but his audience didn't know it, because it was in a language not supposed to be capable of such refinements. He was spare, frugal, hard-boiled. But he did over and over again what only the best writers can ever do at all. He wrote scenes that seemed never to have been written before.
The name Sam Spade was an inspired one. Samuel Dashiell Hammett gave his detective his own unused first name. He was always known as Dash. And a surname indicating that this was a man who called a spade, and not a garden implement. Peter Stead.
Well, Sam Spade, of course, has his origins in this continental op tradition, which the Black Mask writers had already created. Hammett himself wrote about a fairly anonymous, you know, nondescript, overweight, hard-drinking, violent continental ops. And then he moved on to Sam Spade. Now, Spade has become by far the most famous American private detective. The name is always used when people think of this genre. But I think in fairness, in all honesty, Sam Spade was actually a transitional figure between the fairly anonymous continental op tradition on the one hand and Chandler's Marlowe on the other. He's sketched in, really, in Hammett's work. Remember, he's only in one novel, Maltese Falcon, and a couple of stories. We just had this kind of skimp description. And Hammett is writing in the third person for the first time. His previous stories were first person. And he's trying to flesh out the character. But still, I think we're in a transitional process. But the hallmark of Spade as a lone operator, a loner, that's very, very important. And Chandler always saw the significance of Hammett's emphasis on that. But the key to Sam Spade is, unlike the great detective in the English tradition, his main concern is not to solve crimes, but rather just to survive. And if you were to make the contrast with Chandler's Marlowe, I would say that Hammett's Sam Spade is the kind of detective that continental ops would like to have been. whereas Marlowe, of course, is the kind of private operator and private detective that intellectuals would like to have been. You know, the two kind of things come from different directions.
In Hammett's world, women are usually beautiful but treacherous, and woe betide any man who lets himself fall for them.
Hammett, of course, was a womanizer throughout his life, many mistresses. So it was a major thing in his life, in the novels, and indeed in the radio programs. Of course, all women are femme fatale, really. They're people who are using sex. And Sam Spade and the other detectives are very, very aware of this, are very tempted, you know, succumb on occasions, but above all aware of the way in which sex is being used. So there is a kind of moral judgment there, but the tremendous kind of sexual feel to the novels. Women are always chiseling in Hammett and using their sexuality.
Good morning.
Come in, Mr. Spade. Mr. Spade, I have a terrible, terrible confession to make. That story I told you yesterday was all just a story.
Huh. Well, Mr. Shaughnessy, as I said, we didn't exactly believe your story. We believed your $200.
Oh?
Yes, you see, you paid us too much to be telling the truth.
You knew that when you accepted the money?
Oh, I suspected it. I was positive when Joel Cairo called on me.
Joel Cairo?
Yeah. Yeah, he seems interested in Floyd Thursby, too.
Mr. Spade, do they know about me?
No, I don't think they do. I've been able to stall them so far.
Must they know about me at all, Mr. Spade? Couldn't you manage somehow to shield me from them?
Maybe. But I'll have to know what it's all about.
I can't tell you now. Later I will, when I can. You must trust me, Mr. Spade. Oh, I'm so alone and afraid. I've got nobody to help me if you won't help me. Be generous, Mr. Spade. You're strong. You're brave. You can spare me some of that strength and courage, surely.
Sister, you don't need much of anybody's help. You're good. Chiefly your eyes, I think, and that throb you get in your voice when you say things like, be generous, Mr. Spade.
All right. I deserve that. But the lie was in the way I said it. And not at all in what I said.
Ah, now you are dangerous. Have you given me any of your confidence, any of the truth? I can't go ahead without more confidence in you than I have now.
Can't you trust me just a little while?
Well, how much is a little? And what are you waiting for?
I must talk to Joel Cairo.
Well, you can see him tonight. I know where to reach him.
Oh, he can't come here. I can't let him know where I am. I'm afraid.
Well, we'll all meet at my place, then.
All right.
Perhaps the most famous interpreter of the role of Sam Spade was Humphrey Bogart, who played him in John Huston's 1940 film version for Warner Brothers, and subsequently recreated the role on radio before a live audience in 1943 and 1946. Peter Stead.
I think Bogart was perfect. Bogart is dour, he's cynical, he's straight-laced. It's funny because people later associate Bogart with Chandler's Marlowe, but I would say that Bogart was better suited to Sam Spade than he was to Marlowe. And other actors played Marlowe well. Bogart was perfect, I think, as Sam Spade.
Now, look, Angel. Gutman and Cairo will talk when the cops nail them about us. We've only got minutes to get set for the police. Now, give me your whole story fast.
Well, where shall I begin?
The day you first came to my office. Why did you want Thursby shadowed?
I suspected him of betraying me to Gutman, and I wanted to find out.
That's a lie. Gutman tried to make a deal with him. You had Thursby hooked and you knew it. You wanted to get him out of the way before Captain Jacoby arrived with the Falcon. Isn't that so? What was your scheme?
I thought if he saw someone following him, he might be frightened into going away.
Now look, Archer hadn't many brains, but he wasn't clumsy enough to be spotted the first night. You must have told Thursby he was being followed.
I told him. Yes. But please believe me, Sam, I wouldn't have told him if I'd thought Floyd would kill him.
If you thought he wouldn't kill Archie, you were right, Angel.
Didn't he?
Archie had been a detective too long to be caught shadowing a man up a blind alley with his gun tucked away in his hip and his overcoat button. But he'd have gone up there with you, Angel. He was just dumb enough for that.
Sam.
And then you could have stood as close to him as you liked, there in the dark. Put a hole through him with a gun you'd gotten from Thursby that evening.
Don't talk to me like that, Sam. You know I didn't.
Now, the police will be blowing in any minute now, Angel. Talk.
Oh, why do you accuse me of such a terrible...
Why did you shoot Archie? I thought Thursby would tackle him and one or the other would go down. If Thursby was killed, then you were rid of him. If it was Archer, then you could see that Thursby was caught.
Was that it?
Something.
And when
something
you find
like
out
that
Thursby didn't mean to tackle Archie, you borrowed the gun and did it yourself, right?
I guess so.
I know so. You didn't know Gutman was here looking for you until you learned Thursby was shot. Then you needed another protector. So you came back to me.
Yes, but oh, sweetheart, it wasn't only that. I would have come back to you sooner or later. From the very first instant I saw you, I knew that.
Ah, you angel. Well, if you get a good break, you'll be out of San Quentin in 20 years.
Sam, you're not...
Yes, Angel. I'm going to send you over. But if they hang you, I'll always remember you.
Don't, Sam. Don't say that. Even in fun.
It's not fun. I happen to be in the detective business, and you killed my partner. It's bad business to let the killer get away with it. Bad for every detective in this country. You're taking the fall.
Sam Spade became the star of his own radio series in 1946. The Adventures of Sam Spade Detective ran first on CBS and then on NBC until 1951. Howard Duff starred as Sam, and the show was produced and directed by William Spear, a master of radio production who'd created the spine-tingling suspense series. Hammett wrote none of the scripts. Indeed, he'd written almost nothing since 1934 and had been living on the royalties from his books and characters, who included not just Sam Spade, but also Nick and Nora Charles, the husband and wife detective team of MGM's popular Thin Man film series. But the radio writers captured the Hammett style. Peter Stead.
I love the radio series. I, above all, I think they're very entertaining. They're very, very funny, and they're very satisfying in every way. They are, of course, a development from Dashiell Hammett. They always used Hammett's name. But I think we must recognize the input of William Spear, the director, and his team of writers. They've taken the Sam Spade idea and developed it. Some of the hard-boiled tradition, some of that sense of corruption, the violence is there. I thought in the Dick Foley caper, in particular, the wonderful scenes in San Francisco Bay and in the drizzle and the fog and the water.
On the 6 a.m. Oakland ferry boat felt its way blindly out of the slip. Claude Spicer was aboard, and so was I. Should have been getting lighter, but it wasn't. The fog was thickening over the harbor, and most of the passengers were inside drinking coffee. Spicer didn't go in. He climbed up to the boat deck and stood at the rail under the pilot's house. I planted between two wet paint signs and waited. Not for long. I couldn't make out any features on the man who came up and joined them. They stood face to face, not more than a foot apart, and talked in voices that couldn't get to me through the racket of the foghorns in the harbor. What spoke loud enough for me to hear was a gun. They seemed to fall into each other's arms, then collapsed in a heap on the deck. When I got to the spot, only the dead one was there. It was Spicer. The other man had disappeared around the corner of the deckhouse. A ray of light from the pilot's window swept over him, and I saw gunmetal shine in his hand and then spin out over the rail as he threw it.
What? Oh, it's you, Sam. Oh, I was afraid you'd lost him.
What did you do it for, Dick?
I had my reason, Sam. Now, trust me, I'll keep you in the clear.
How long? As long as I go on playing sucker for you?
What do you think I hired you for?
Maybe I was supposed to say you killed him in self-defense. Maybe I was supposed to see him making passes at your wife if you needed that.
But, Sam, you've got to...
I've worked for killers before. I've even worked for thieves. But not for a detective that knocks over a place he's supposed to be protecting.
Sam, it's not a...
Save it for the cops, Dick. I'm turning you in when we get to Oakland.
No, you're not, Sam.
Dick, come back here.
Let go of me. I'm going over the side. If you try to stop me, you're going with me.
He fought away from me, got one foot over the rail, and kicked out at me with the other. It caught me on the point of the chin. I stumbled forward and grabbed out blind. I must have caught him by the belt just as he jumped. I remember something pulling me halfway over the rail and trying to get free of it. I did, but not soon enough. I was in midair, and the black water came rushing up to meet me. Mechanically keeping afloat somehow and trying to get out of my coat. I felt heavy and logged as if I'd swallowed gallons of water. The murk hung low and thick. There was nothing else to be seen anywhere. I swallowed what felt like several more gallons before I got rid of the coat. From out of the misty fog blanket, from every direction, in a dozen different keys, from near and far, foghorns sounded. I stopped swimming and floated on my back trying to determine my whereabouts. After a while, I picked out the moaning, evenly spaced blasts of the Alcatraz siren. But they came out of the fog without direction. It seemed to beat down on me from straight above. I was somewhere in San Francisco Bay, and that was all I knew. I suspected the current was sweeping me out toward the Golden Gate. And a light came up ahead of me suddenly. A boat passing a few yards away. I lifted my head and screamed. The boat siren, crying its warning, drowned out my shouts. Went on fast, and the fog closed in behind it. Then I heard a new sound. Seagulls. I swam towards it, and it seemed to get lighter. Part of it was the dawn light beginning to cut through the fog blanket. But there was also a strange-looking man standing on the water and waving a green lantern back and forth. I yelled at him to wait for me, and a seagull got off his hat and flew away. When I got closer, I saw that it was not a man, but only a buoy, channel type. I used all the strength I had left to drag myself up on the base of it and let it rock me to sleep.
They are capers. They're very, very amusing, very, very funny. The initial wordplay between Sam Spade and his secretary Effie, or the stand-in Bernadine, is wonderful. All the kind of, you know, the jokes there, the double entendres, the spoonerisms, and so on, are very, very funny, and they're a reminder of the way in which America was inventing a new language.
Office of Samuel Spade, Private Investments. I mean Investigations. Good morning. Evening.
Effie?
Miss Perrine is on a vacation. Perhaps I may be of assistance, no doubt.
I don't know. To whom am I speaking to?
I am sorry. I cannot divulge that information to an entire stranger. May I take a message?
Look, Miss, whoever you are, I don't want to discommode you, but...
I am sorry, but I will have to ask you in no certain terms to resist from this line you are handing me. I am not the type secretary...
Forget it. I'll just call Miss Perrine long distance and dictate my report over the phone.
Oh, my stars and God, how utterly gouch of me, Mr. Spade. Oh, I'm Bernadine, Effie's relief. I mean yours.
I could use some.
Oh, shall I send out for some medicine?
This is one of the great things. This is why, you know, we like Groucho Marx. This is why we like so many of those films in the 30s. They were coming to terms with the English language and creating a new language of the American streets. And I think the radio program... you know, captures that superbly, as, of course, do so many of the American B-films of that time. And these programs, I think, on the whole, can be compared with the B-film tradition. Spade's, you know, one-liners, which are far more to the writers than they do to Dashiell Hammett, I think, are very, very funny. At one point, Sam Spade describes to Effie what had been a brilliant quadruple play, who uses the baseball term. And she says, I know nothing about baseball. He says, don't worry, the football season starts next week. So... they have a life of their own, and above all, they're given a life, I think, by superb production values, above all, the voices. The voices, you know, the voices in American radio are wonderful. From Dick Joy, you know, the announcer, the voices in the adverts are very, very impressive. All the characters are well played. But above all, you know, there's Howard Duff's superb, urbane, wistfully cynical voice. He's absolutely perfect. I think this is really, really high-class radio.
But the show came to a sad end. A victim of the McCarthyite anti-communist witch hunt in 40s and 50s America.
Yes, this is, you know, this kind of sad aspect of American anxiety as the Cold War set in. America had won the war, America had solved the problems of depression, but instead of embracing its freedom, America wallowed in guilt. And that pursuit of communists in America and the fellow travelers in America, which we associate with the McCarthyite era, really starts in about 1947 and goes on for 5 or 6 years and affected, you know, almost every aspect of American life, American politics, and American culture. Once Truman introduced his kind of loyalty pledge and his loyalty test in 1947, there was carte blanche, really, for the Inquisition, as it's been called, to be taken to every aspect of American life. Hammett was a Marxist, almost certainly a member of the Communist Party. Hammett himself was to go to jail in 1951 for refusing to give names to a U.S. district court. He was himself grilled by McCarthy himself in 1953. So Hammett was quite a central figure in that whole period of the American Inquisition, and inevitably the radio program suffered.
The magazine Hollywood Life published one of many virulent anti-Hammett articles.
Hammett is one of the most dangerous, influential communists in America. Communism has been his first love for many years, and he has aided the Moscow methods with thousands of dollars and most of his spare time. Hammett is said to be responsible for selling the Red Banner to dozens of men and women, including actor Howard Duff, alias Sam Spade. Duff is also a member of one or more Red Fronts and a definite Red sympathizer. Truthfully, Dashiell Hammett should be indicted for participating in subversive activities and aiding in matters which seek and conspire to overthrow the United States government.
In 1949, Wild Root Hair Oil, the sponsor of the Sam Spade radio show, insisted that Hammett's name be removed from the show's credits. They then decided to pull the plug on the show altogether. This decision prompted 250,000 letters from fans urging its reprieve. The show was continued, but without Howard Duff, who was replaced by Stephen Dunn. An anti-communist message was injected into the scripts as Sam rounded up communist spies and fifth columnists and warned audiences against them.
Oh, Sam. A spy story.
Yes, it was, Eff.
Everything. A chase and being thrown in the water and mysterious people and a code message.
Well, that kept you awake, Angel.
Sam.
Huh?
What is it like not to want to be in America? Not to want to live the way we do in America.
I can't imagine, sweetheart.
I can't either. Sam, about Dr. Ames.
Yeah?
Do you think that, the way you described him, Earl, do you think you made him sound too sympathetic?
Well, I described him as he was, that's all.
But will anybody think that, he was attractive?
Well, you missed the whole point, didn't you? Spies don't go around wearing monocles and talking with heavy accents and acting like spies. Not the good ones. It's the attractive, lovable, trustworthy strangers that are dangerous. Now, if you'd met Dr. Ames at a party somewhere, you'd be out with him at a nightclub right now, cooing over a drink and giving him the plans to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Sometimes I can't...
I get mad, Sam. I don't even know where Brooklyn is.
Lucky for our side.
But the series did not long survive the departure of Howard Duff and ended in 1951. Howard Duff went on to become a successful film and television star in the kind of tough guy roles in which he'd made his name on radio. Dashiell Hammett was released from prison in December 1951. He wrote nothing more before his death in January 1961. But on hearing of his death, columnist John Crosby wrote, "Dashiell Hammett, who died the other day, was that rare thing, a shaker of the earth, an authentic. The Maltese Falcon was one of the best books of its kind ever written. It struck the publishing world and the reading world like a thunderclap. Nothing has been the same since."
The Adventures of Sam Spade, Dashiell Hammett's famous private detective, are produced and directed by William Spear. Sam Spade is played by Howard Duff. Lorene Tuttle is Effie. The Adventures of Sam Spade are written for radio by Bob Tallman and Gil Dowd. Musical direction by Lut Gluskin, with score composed by Renee Garrigan. Join us again next Sunday when author Dashiell Hammett and producer William Spear join forces for another adventure with Sam Spade. Brought to you by Wild Root Cream Oil. Again and again, the choice of men who put good grooming first.
The Radio Detectives was written and presented by Professor Jeffrey Richards. Readings were by Toby Longworth, and the producer was Liz Anstey.